is our final speaker, Commissioner Rachel Barco, who joins us from NYU. She's a commissioner, not in the typical sense that we might discuss in our local government. She's a commissioner of the United States Sentencing Commission. As a criminal defense lawyer myself, someone I look to for guidance and often try and quote to federal judges and talk about the wisdom in their commentary, perhaps. But she joins us today and wears many hats. Not only is she a professor at NYU, not only is she on the U.S. Sentencing Commission, having been confirmed by the Senate, but she also serves on the Manhattan District Attorney's Conviction Integrity Unit, another important hat that she wears. But perhaps probably the most important hat she wears is the one she puts on when she goes to teach her students, who have awarded her last year the NYU Distinguished Faculty Member in a university-wide poll. And I hope that, as a former student of many professors myself, I hope that's one that she treasures the most. So I welcome her here to the podium. So.
So this is the unenviable task of what stands between you and getting to go home. So I'm going to move this because I'm short enough as it is. So thanks so much for having me. This has been a really enjoyable day for me. Even though the shorthand title for me in the program is as a sentencing commissioner, I'm really speaking to you in my capacity as an academic. I don't know if, which is worse for you, bureaucrat or academic, but the reason I'm doing that is because I've been teaching criminal law and administrative law courses at NYU since 2002, and my entire scholarly agenda is focused on how you take administrative law principles and apply them to improving criminal law. So today's session is particularly relevant to me. Now, I'm not the first person to have seen this connection between administrative law and criminal law. 40 years ago, about the time that the administrative conference was being established, a little bit after that, Sandy Kadish had argued that criminal law requires its own administrative law. A couple years after that, Kenneth Culp Davis also talked about the fact that prosecutors in their administrative discretion called for similar judicial review that we see for other agencies. And more recently, Judge Jerry Lynch, in a great article called Our Administrative System of Justice, made the case for why prosecutorial discretion over charging and plea bargaining should be viewed as an example of administrative law. So all these commentators share in common the recognition that the administration of criminal justice largely takes place outside courtrooms and is done by agencies. Now, this is not the way you see criminal law on TV or in movies. So you can imagine if Law and Order, where I think almost every one of my students until they enroll in law school get their knowledge of American criminal justice, if it started off in the criminal justice system that people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups, the police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. They make up a vast regulatory system where a fraction of the cases go to trial and the rest are informally adjudicated and the process is entirely controlled by regulatory actors. And this is that administrative process. So that's not what anyone wants to watch, and so we don't see it, and instead we cling to this trial myth, but in fact the reality of our system is that it is administrative. In the federal system, 97% of the cases where someone receives a conviction have never seen a trial. And in this system, the regulators consist of the prosecutors, who, as Judge Lynch had observed, are the final adjudicators. And as we've heard today in the context of regulatory crimes, they decide what charges to bring, whether they're going to enter into cooperation agreements, and what pleas to accept. And then we also have law enforcement agents as key gatekeepers with discretion to decide what cases they're going to investigate, what areas and offenses they're going to target, whom they're going to arrest. At the United States Sentencing Commission, where I'm a member, we set sentencing guidelines that operate in the federal system. We issue proposed rules for comment, just like other administrative agencies, though interestingly, unlike other agencies, we are not subject to judicial review for those rules. The Bureau of Prisons decides where and how to incarcerate offenders, controlling prison placement programs and sanctions within the prisons. So all these agencies are dominating the system in the sense that they're making all the key decisions. And yet, despite the fact that we've now been told for a very long time that this is a process dominated by agencies. There's been very little work to consider what that means and what we should do about it. So I'm really happy that the Administrative Conference is taking up this task. And what I'd like to do is give you two guideposts from administrative law that I think work well for improving criminal law and that I hope you will focus on. The first is the rich body of information from administrative law about how you design and structure an agency in the first place, so that it can achieve its goals without abusing its powers. And the second is the use of data and cost-benefit analysis. So I'll start with institutional design, which I think is neglected in criminal law. And I think if we focused on the internal design of agencies, we could correct some of the abuses that people have talked about today, as well as abuses that exist across the entire criminal justice spectrum. So I'll give you two examples from my work that draw upon administrative law and the Administrative Procedure Act to show you how this would work. So first, if you think about a U.S. Attorney's Office, that how could we think about changing the structure of that? Well, the Administrative Procedure Act prohibits people who investigate cases from being part of the decision-making process about how a case should be resolved. And that's because the drafters of the APA thought that people who start pursuing and investigating cases develop a bias about those cases and a will to win those cases. So they shouldn't be part of the decision-making process of what ultimately happens to the targets of those investigations. If we took that same principle, which I think applies in all contexts to U.S. attorneys' offices, we would not want prosecutors who are investigating cases to be the same people who decide what charges to bring and what pleas to accept, right? Because they too might have a bias. Now, you can also think about this at the Department of Justice level, which has another problem with conflicts. So the same department that handles prosecutions is also in charge of corrections, forensics, and clemency. So you could see where there might be a need for structural reform there because those missions conflict with each other, and you'd want some kind of check on that to make sure that law enforcement interests aren't overwhelming those other concerns. All right, so that's just a couple examples to give you a flavor for this, and hopefully you could see how they could apply to regulatory crimes or anything else. The second thing I want to focus on is the idea of cost-benefit analysis or thinking about data. Now, in every regulatory system, and this is true of criminal justice as well, regulators can fail to appreciate the trade-offs and downsides when they're pursuing their goals. It's not because they're biased, it's not because they're acting in bad faith. I think they're almost entirely acting in good faith, but there is a tunnel vision that naturally develops. So when they argued for cost-benefit analysis in the executive branch for traditional regulatory agencies, Christopher DeMuth and Doug Ginsburg wrote in 1986 that a regulatory agency, quote, will invariably wish to spend too much on its goals, end quote, because the agency's success is measured by those goals. So what they argued was that you needed a countervailing constraint. And they urged review by an office that has no program responsibilities so that more balanced decisions could be made. For federal regulatory agencies, as this crowd knows, that check comes from the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. And it demands that agencies present them with cost-benefit analysis of any proposed rules and an explanation as to why didn't the agency pursue alternatives. There is nothing like that framework for federal criminal actors. And without that kind of check or oversight on their actions, key criminal justice actors may fail to see that there are approaches beyond what they're doing, or to appreciate that resources are limited. So for decades, what we've seen is that federal criminal justice actors have been doing is locking up record numbers of people so that we now lead the world by far in incarceration rates. So what would it look like if we paid closer attention to costs and benefits? And I think if we look at the Sentencing Commission and the kind of data it provides that serves similar purposes, it can show you how information can be valuable to a decision-making process. So the Sentencing Commission can estimate how many prison beds Congress will save, for example, if it enacts mandatory minimum reforms, just as the Sentencing Commission was able to estimate the number of prison beds that will be saved from our recent vote to reduce drug sentences. Now, as part of our vote and our consideration of whether to pass sentencing reform, we also looked at data that compared the recidivism rates of offenders who had received a reduction in crack sentences compared to the recidivism rate of similarly situated people who didn't get the reduction. All right, and we wanted to see, did it matter that they received lower sentences? And in fact, the group that got the lower sentences had a lower recidivism rate. Now, it wasn't statistically significant, but what it showed clearly was that they didn't have a higher recidivism rate. So what we were able to look at was data that showed lowering prison sentences provides a benefit in the form of prison cost savings that the Attorney General told us was money that could be used for other law enforcement needs, like hiring more law enforcement agents and prosecutors. And we weren't seeing from our data a cost in terms of recidivism rates going up. So now we're going to keep a closer eye on data like this, but it's a larger point that I'm making here, and that's the fact that we should want all of our criminal justice decisions made with a focus on data like this, whether it's charging policies by prosecutors, prison programming decisions by BOP. But unfortunately, this is just not what the criminal justice system has been doing. And it just lacks the most basic checking mechanisms, institutional separation, cost-benefit analysis that we see in other regulatory contexts. And I think the reason these controls are absent is we just don't view the criminal justice system in regulatory administrative law terms. People just tend to see it, as was mentioned earlier today, as a bunch of high-profile stories. But in fact, it's a big regulatory apparatus. And I think once we see it that way, it'll pave the way for us seeing the kinds of controls that we can profitably apply to it. Now, I think we're starting to see this shift in thinking about this. I think today's event is a good example. I also think the demand for evidence-based practices in criminal law, the call to be smart on crime, not just tough on crime, these are examples of that kind of thinking. But the efforts really are sporadic in this sphere, and even when expertise and evidence and data is out there, it's often ignored. The Sentencing Commission, for example, has a wealth of information on mandatory minimums and other sentencing practices. But it's often just ignored by policymakers. For years, the commission has highlighted significant and troubling problems with mandatory minimums, yet its reports have been ignored until just recently. Now, in light of the evidence that we have amassed as an agency, we sent a letter to Congress representing the unanimous view of the commission, and we are a collection of Democrat and Republican appointees, that reform is necessary. But it remains unclear even now whether Congress will act to reform mandatory minimum sentences. And there are countless other criminal justice policies and issues that have had the same fate, where there's just been this lack of interest in getting the administrative architecture set up correctly or weighing the costs and benefits. Now, since today's focus has been on regulatory crimes, I'm going to conclude with an emphasis on how we could think about these concepts applied to that particular area. So first, if we think about the deferred and non-prosecution agreements that has been mentioned have been increasingly reached with companies, we know there's been a dramatic rise in these agreements. Between 1993 and 2001, there were 11. Since 2001, it's now 250. And it's actually more than that. And Lanny Brewer, when he was heading the criminal division, said, quote, they're a mainstay of white-collar criminal law enforcement. They've recovered billions and billions of dollars in monetary fines, but they're much broader than that. They often require companies to stop participating in specific lines of business, even legal ones, to change their business practices, to fire particular employees or officers. And in roughly half of these agreements, the government requires the company to install a monitor to make sure that compliance with the agreement's regulatory terms is met. And DOJ has been very explicit when it uses these, as you've heard, that it views them as a force for positive change in corporate culture. All right, now, the debate was earlier about, you know, should they be done instead of seeking guilty pleas or not charging at all. But I want to think about it as an administrative law matter. So my questions are a little bit different. First of all, where's the analysis of the terms in these agreements to be sure that they're actually imposing sound business practices? Do we know that the benefits of the terms in these agreements outweigh the costs? Are there better ones, better terms that the department should have been insisting on instead? And why doesn't the department have some kind of centralized oversight over what kinds of terms are being put in these agreements, given that many of these cases raise similar issues, yet offices around the country are reaching different conclusions about what should be done? Now, if you look at the approach the department takes when we're talking about individuals, it's really no more rigorous than that about individual regulatory prosecutions. Here, I think we should also be asking, is criminalization necessary and effective in achieving the goals of the regulatory scheme, Or would other mechanisms work better or more cost-effectively? All right, so we should ask that big question of, do we actually need criminal enforcement to make these regulatory schemes work? And then even if we say yes, we should, there's a further question that we should ask, not just in regulatory crimes, but in every criminal context involving criminal penalties. What quantum of punishment is necessary to deter violations? You know, how much punishment is the right amount? Now, for some would-be individual violators of regulations, the prospect of prison and the collateral consequences of a conviction might be necessary. These people might view civil penalties as just the cost of doing business that they're going to pass along to their consumers. And if not, then because they don't own a business to pass through the fines, or the fines are too high, bankruptcy might be an option for some that gives them a fresh start. Whereas a prison sentence and the stigma of a conviction can't be passed through to somebody else. All right, so we'd want to know in this area, as in all others, what the costs and benefits are of using criminal punishment, and decide whether that's the best use of federal dollars or whether there are less costly options that would be just as effective. So civil regulatory agencies are, as we've heard today, are often underfunded to achieve their goals. And so maybe money that would otherwise go towards prison would be better spent on more civil personnel to investigate and detect violations. We know from the deterrence literature, and this is true across a range of crimes, that a would-be offender cares much more about the odds of detection than about the length of their sentence. So catching people matters more than giving them a longer sentence. So if it turns out that deterrence can be achieved just as effectively at a lesser cost, that would free up funds to use for other measures. Now, I have no views on any of this. I lack the data, the expertise to know whether we need criminal provisions in a given regulatory area. So all I want to do is highlight that I think these are the questions we should be asking. We should be asking with regulatory crimes and every other crime, is criminalization necessary to achieve the goals? And if so, how much prison time actually, if we're going to use prison, how much makes sense? And when we're thinking about whether to make incarceration an option, I think it's really important to keep in mind it can have a negative effect on public safety. All right, so it's true that while someone is serving their sentence, they're incapacitated from committing more crimes, and that's a benefit. But you have to weigh that against the fact that some individuals become more prone to committing crimes once they're released because of the greater difficulty they have in maintaining family ties and obtaining employment when they ultimately get out. And all this is exacerbated by the collateral consequences that flow from felony convictions that make it very hard for people to reintegrate into society and lead a law-abiding life going forward. So you want to weigh all of this when you're thinking about this. So just to conclude, I'll say we've heard that where regulatory crimes stand in terms of the overall criminal justice system, and so they're by numbers, they are a small fraction. And so what I'm hoping is that the administrative conference will not just look at those, which I think is a good topic for them to look at, but will look at the bigger issues that don't just affect traditional regulatory spheres. This is the most obvious example, I think, maybe, of where you see administrative law and criminal law coming together. But I hope I've made the claim that, in fact, the entire criminal justice system is a regulatory system. And it's administrative in every important way, except that it's not subject to any of the same legal and structural oversight mechanisms, which is something I think should change. So when President Obama described the administrative conference, he said it was a, quote, public-private partnership designed to make the government work better. And I think that the government could be working significantly better in criminal justice, and I'm very pleased to see that the administrative conference has put it on the agenda to look closely at criminal law. So I think we're still going to end pretty much on time, and I thank you and all the organizers of the conference for inviting me today.